Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And we're continuing our conversation about his book, Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Well, it's a pleasure for me, too.
Now, this I love this book, and every part of it is fascinating. But when I got to the chapters about the Red Sea and then people boating over to India, for some reason, that chapter really captured my imagination. Why is that? I mean, it just was fascinating to me. I knew nothing about it. And the times that you were talking about, it was just very fascinating to me.
You actually put your finger right on it, because the fascinating thing about this is that nobody knows anything about it. It's really something that's off most people's historical radar. It doesn't happen to be off mine, because when I was young, I worked in East Africa and got very captivated by the East African coast and saw coastal dhows and talked to the skippers of them and so on. And I've had an enduring fascination with this, being a sailor myself, ever since.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just an incredible story.
Let's talk about the Red Sea in itself. You call it a vicious ocean. In what way?
It's vicious because it gets very strong northerly winds. There are relatively few good anchorages for any form of sailing boat, let alone a steamboat. And it is extremely hot. And you put all that together, and it's very difficult for a boat that can't sail against the wind to get up there. In fact, if you want to take a yacht up there, you've got to be very careful with your weather. It's a very inhospitable environment, that apart from the aridity of the desert.
Now, let's talk about the ancient people there. There's an ancient people that Greek geographers called the Ichthyophagi.
Yes, the fish-eaters.
Who were they?
The fish eaters are really in the shadows of history. They were people who lived by the coast of the Indian Ocean and probably on the coasts of Saudi Arabia and elsewhere as well. They subsisted off coastal fisheries and shellfish. And they lived in areas where, or places where there was water, springs or rivers. And they had very little contact with anybody except people who were traveling down on the ocean. And they had a huge advantage to these people because, firstly, they could provide them with dried fish, which
has
always been a rather invisible staple for mariners. And then also they could get water.
You make this point several times throughout the book, and I don't think people – it's one of those things I never learned, but the importance of dried fish – for navigators and for explorers, you can't underestimate the importance of the dried fish wherever people were sailing at that time.
No, you cannot. And it was, as I think actually we talked about it in an earlier interview, it was the beef jerky of the Norse in the North Sea, for example, and it became a staple of naval rations and indeed rations on land for armies. So yeah, it's an absolutely fundamental staple.
Now, there's so much detail in this book that just fascinates me. You write that they prepared the fish by trotting on it. What is that to? And do we have any modern peoples that do the same thing? I mean, how do you prepare fish by trotting on it?
Oh, you dovetail them. So you butterfly them so they get flat. And some of them, they would just stand on them and do it. And then you put them on racks and dry them in the sun.
And you said that they mixed it with the fruit of Christ's thorn. What is that?
It's an indigenous thorn brush there, which has qualities which help in the drying of the fish.
Now,
it's
people,
quite a well-known plant.
Now, people who were in ancient peoples who are sailing south through the Red Sea, how far are they going?
They're going all the way down.
To the coast of Africa, or
they got down to the bottom of the Red Sea, to the Narrows. And at that point, they had a choice. They could go right and coast down the coast of Africa, or they could go left and go along to Socotra, which, of course, was a major center of spices, even in ancient Egyptian times, and then go across and along the south coast of what is now Saudi Arabia. the choice was dictated very considerably by when they were there and also by what they were looking for. And it wasn't until the 2nd century BC, I think, if I recall, that an Alexandrian sailor, he must have been a merchant called Hippalus, discovered the rhythm of the monsoon winds, which blow from the northeast for 6 months a year and southwest for the other six, which is fabulous because that means for 6 months you can go east and for 6 months you can go west. And this was the staple which caused the monsoon trade of the Indian Ocean, particularly the East African coast. And then, of course, it also carried Portuguese navigator Vasco da Gama to India in 1499. So it was vital. And it was well known. It was probably known long before Hippalus wrote about it in his book. And it was the ideal way to coast along the Saudi Arabian shore. With a Latin rig, you could go close to the ocean.
I want to talk about this, the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. Have you read that? I mean, can you get an English language translation of that?
Yes.
I'm fascinated. Talk to me about that.
There were monographs galore on it. It was a Greek set of sailing directions, which is called a periplus, a walking around, written by a guy who we don't know who he was, who was clearly a merchant, and he clearly had sailed these waters himself, because there was the ring of first-hand knowledge in it. And you can read, I've read it in Greek and English, it is really, you go to this place here, you will find people with canoes. Here you will find fish that are dangerous. Here the people are friendly. Here you can get iron. And this was based on the monsoon routes, and it goes all the way across to India and all the way down the East African coast, probably as far as northern Mozambique. And there was a huge literature, especially with the African part, trying to identify who was there, where they were, and so on. And it's an absolute classic. It isn't very long, but it is the Bible of monsoon sailing, or was for centuries.
And we're talking about the 1st century AD is when it was first written?
That's right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Now,
there are lots of translations of it. Look at it for it on Amazon, it's there.
Oh, man. Now, I've got to ask, what are people sailing? I mean, these seem like enormous trips. When people are sailing over to India from the Red Sea or down the coast of Africa, these are hugely long trips for that time period.
They are indeed, but I mean, what you have to realize is two things. One, that the vast majority of these voyages were coasting voyages, and they would literally coast from the one known anchorage to another, from one headland to another.
Got it.
Trading with people on the way.
So were you never that far out of the sight of land?
Not necessarily. If you're going down to the East African coast from the Red Sea, you coasted along the coast of Somalia and then the coast of Kenya and Tanzania.
Okay.
Some of the navigation was tricky because there were coral reefs. But these guys knew the ocean like the back of their hands.
Wow.
But the other trip is to go along what they call Hadramat, the coast of Saudi Arabia coast. And then at a certain point, you ease off and use the southwestern monsoon to sail across to India. This is a straightforward trip. The winds can be strong sometimes, but the wind's always behind you, and you knew at the other end was the coast because they'd found it by coasting. Wow. And at the same time, there was an ancient coasting trade. It still goes on between the Indus Valley area of India and the Persian Gulf. So it was a mixture of both. But the great discovery was that you could go from East Africa to India and back in the course of a year. What they probably did was go up to Saudi Arabia and then across. But they could also go across. But the reason they went to Saudi Arabia, because there was a flourishing trade, believe it or not, in mangrove wood poles, which are harvested in the swamps of East African rivers and gulfs, and taken to Saudi Arabia. It was a staple of trade for centuries.
What were they used for?
Housing. schemes for houses. So, basically, the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia are treeless.
Yep.
So they did that. But the trade, the monsoon trade itself, was in all sorts of things. There were staples like iron ore, ivory, because the ivory of the Indian Ocean, Indian elephant is easily carvable, where that of the African elephant is much more brittle.
Right.
There was, of course, although it's not fashionable to mention it, a trade in slaves.
Right.
The trade in cotton from India, cotton cloth, was huge. Glass beads from India. And all this stuff came to the East African coast and then was traded in exchange for gold and copper.
Again, this just sort of captures my imagination, because you get the sense that there's a these sailors have to have been used to meeting many different kinds of cultures and many different languages along the way. They have to have been versed in a bunch of different languages.
Oh, yes. And there is another marvelous book, which actually I think you'd really enjoy, Mark. It's a book by a guy called Alan Villiers. It's in the bibliography of fishing. He spent a year just before War II sailing on a dhow for a year as part of the crew.
Wow.
And this is the most gorgeous, vivid description of what it was like to coast in an Arab dhow, and how the skipper had a wife in every port, and the smuggling, and the harvesting. It's absolutely fascinating. It just glues you to your seat. And his description of the last bit of the book, of the passage home, going through the shallows with a skipper who knew every foot of the ground under the water, is truly amazing.
So
if you want to know what the monsoon trade is, there it is.
So were people sailing in dhows at that point?
Oh, yeah. They stole.
Now, I know I've seen pictures of dhows. How maneuverable are they, and how large would they be?
Dhows can be of considerable size. Today, of course, Arab sheikhs, wealthy ones, build large luxury ones. Top of my head, 60, 70 feet, some of them. They have huge lateen mainsails, which have long yards, which are quite tricky to handle in heavy weather, but they can go very close to the wind, and you can beat against the northeast wind monsoon along the coast with this. And these guys were really good skippers.
They would have to be.
They were superb. They lived it.
Yeah.
That was their life. But the other thing which people don't realize is just how sophisticated Arab navigation was.
Huh.
It's been discovered and really comprehensively studied in the last few years, and it was superb. It was based on the heavenly bodies, on the monsoons, on knowing the coast. They were as good as Europeans, if not better. They were really good.
Now, again, for the benefit of the audience, people have to realize this is before the discovery of the compass. So they're doing it the hard way.
They didn't think it was the hard way. No, they did it.
That was the way they did it.
Yeah, it was as natural to them as going to the bathroom in the morning. And you know, it was part of their lives, very intimate relationship with the ocean.
Now, I want to talk about fishing just for a moment before we move on along this trip. You're right that people did net fishing. They used these nets made out of bast fiber. Were they, yep. You just sort of waded in the water and you threw them off the shore and sort of caught what you could?
Yeah, you have weights with them. You put them out from canoes or little boats or rafts and just put them out there in shallow water, yeah.
And then they also had copper hooks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Do we have a lot of examples of those? Are they barbed hooks? I mean, what do they look like?
No, you don't find many of them. You'll find quite a few historic ones. But copper, you see, in Mesopotamia goes back, almost 5,000 years. But it was a very good thing to use for fish hooks because it doesn't bend and break as easily as, say, fiber or shell, which was the other one they used.
Now, I want to talk about, let's talk about the southern route first, down along the coast of Africa. What major cities were there were along the route?
There were all sorts of, well, the word city is kind of misnomer.
Yeah, okay.
We look at it with the idea of Portuguese fort at Mombasa and so on. What there were trading centers. And some of these places were small towns, which are known to archaeologists and anthropologists as stone towns, because they were built of coral and cemented together. And some of them have quite elaborate palaces. Malindi is one, Lamu is another, Mombasa was another one. Kilwa down in the south was a famous one, where powerful sheikhs lived, local leaders, who really controlled the trade. And you went from one trading center to another. But in other places, way south, for example, there were a couple of places they'd been looking for years, but they finally figured out that they were probably seasonal camps that sprang up during the Dao season and then vanished when the trading was finished. So it was very informal trade, but the trade was very lucrative because it was in poles, iron ore, copper, and gold. And Africa, with its ivory and so on, gave huge amounts of raw materials to the outside world, and in return received goods like cloth, which were a fraction of the value of the gold.
Jeez. There was a cape known as the Cape of Spices. Where was that?
That's up in Somalia.
And it was obviously a center of spice trade?
Well, Socotra is.
Oh, okay.
The island, yeah.
Right.
Really, Socotra is the famous center. And, of course, that goes back to the ancient Egyptians. You know, they were trading for spices down there. Spices is one of the kind of fundamentals of the trade. Even the Chinese came over.
Now let's talk about the traders going all the way to India from the Arabian shore. How long a trip would that be?
Say
from the southern part of the Red Sea over to the first ports, or maybe the Indus River.
Yeah, it depends which way you go. You could do it comfortably in 2 months.
Wow.
Quicker if you had a right boat. Of course, a lot of the early boats weren't lateens, which are really imported from the Mediterranean. They were boats with square sails, which was much slower.
Now, once they got to India, there are several cities that or concentrations of people that they visited. One of them was called Balakot on the bay. It was near the Indus River. Talk to me about what that was like.
That was the Indus River, of course, was the center of the very famous Harappan society or Indus civilization of a couple of thousand years BC. And that was a major trader with Mesopotamia. But the trade continued, and the places, that, like the one you just mentioned, were in fact fishing villages where people supplied fish to the traders that were coasting up and down the coast. So it was a well-organized trade.
And there were also these cities, Harappa, Mohenjo-daro.
Yep.
And you write that for the Indus leaders, cities functioned as a means of organizing and controlling their society. Describe more what you mean by that.
Yeah, these cities were large. They were well organized. They had elaborate flood defenses. But they were very centralized. And this was needed because a great deal of this civilization depended on irrigation agriculture and also on control of the fairly intensive trading activity up and down the river. But what's striking is that these were not militaristic civilizations. It appears that the major source of authority was the spiritual and political ability of the leaders. Who the leaders were, what their names were, history does not record, because unfortunately, so far, we've been unable to decipher Indus script.
That's right. So there are scripts from that time period. We have no idea what they say.
No, but they've been working on it for years. But
For decades, they've been working on that.
Yeah, but they haven't cracked them yet.
Oh, my God.
And of course, you see, the monsoon trade goes way over towards India, towards China.
That's right. Now, let's just spend a moment talking about China, because you have a whole section on Chinese fishing, which I find fascinating. But for me, as a birder, one of the things that I'm always fascinated is that they were able to domesticate cormorants to help them fish. Talk to me about that.
Oh, well, the way they did that was to put a ring around the cormorant's neck so it couldn't swallow the fish it would dig. Because cormorants are very good fishermen, and these fishermen trained the cormorants to catch fish for them, and they were very efficient. And in fact, there were examples of one cormorant helping another one land a big fish. This was an extremely big part of Chinese fishing. Whether it still is, I don't know. The big thing in Chinese fishing now is, of course, fish farming, which is enormous.
It is huge
pioneers there.
That's absolutely true. Now, in the waters between India and China, and I know this was true, I think right up until today, there was a huge problem with piracy there, isn't there?
That I don't know about. In the context, I'm sure there was. in the context of fishing, fishing just went on. But there's no question there was piracy. There was chronic piracy along the Chinese coast as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's very established. And one of the reasons that this famous Chinese navigator, Zheng Ho, went across the Indian Ocean to East Africa and even went to Mecca, or some of his people did, and India, was because they were trying to establish the power of China among leaders who were far, far away.
Now, the other thing the Chinese were famous for, you mentioned fish farming. Well, that goes back to the beginnings of Chinese civilization. They wrote a lot about carp farming.
Yes, they did indeed. And fish farming, contrary to a lot of people's belief, is not just a question of creating a pond and shoving fish in it, or fish spawn. It is a very sophisticated business. And one of the early pioneers who wrote a book about it was actually made a fortune and then gave it away and then made another fortune from fish farming, which he started experimenting with things like planting mulberry trees by the ponds and encouraging different environments for the fish, which worked very well. But originally it started with Amur carp, which are a Chinese species, in rivers like the Yangtze.
Now, we're going to run out of time. We only have a few minutes left. And one of the things I want to address that we haven't really talked about is the future of fishing now. You have this incredible book which details how important fish and fishing around the world, South America, Asia, Africa, is. Yet I look at what's happening now, and I have nothing but trepidation when I look at what the future of fishing is going to mean for the countries around the world.
You are absolutely correct. It is a very serious problem indeed. When you reflect that well over half the fish eaten in Asia are now farmed, it's clear that we have a crisis. And at the crisis, there were libraries of books on this, which is one of the reasons I didn't get into it. I have no desire to beat apocalyptic drums, which have been beaten very hard, almost to the point of exclusion. But the fact of the matter is we have a crisis, and the issue is how do we control and make fishing sustainable? Can we succeed in doing it? The answer is in Europe and parts of America, they're beginning to have success with this. And combined with fish farming, which of course has its own problems, you can hopefully create more sustainable fishing than there is now. But if you look at things like the global tuna fisheries, which are being decimated, the answer is very serious. This requires a level of international cooperation, which at the moment is still very much in its infancy. One of the fascinating things that I've been taught about fishing, and indeed is true of hunting too, is that this isn't just a problem for Denmark or China or America. It's a problem for all of us. And the sooner we tackle this as a global issue, the better off we're going to be, because the future of the world is global, not national.
That's absolutely right. Do you believe that the future of fishing, therefore, is going to be fish farming?
Part of it's fish farming. Part of it is an insistence on the part of consumers that they only eat sustainable fish, which a lot of restaurants are now doing.
That's right. But it seems like I know that people like want to eat those big, juicy steaks of tuna and swordfish because they have a certain consistency. But unfortunately, those are the least sustainable fish.
They're also very difficult to farm.
Very
complex cultural issues here. Because, I mean, the Japanese really treasure tuna as a fish to eat, which is a cultural custom one must respect. The issue is, are the nations of the world ready to spend big money on protecting it and policing the fisheries? The answer at the moment is, it appears not. But a lot of people are going to be very hungry unless we do.
And it's such a part of the world culture. You read a book like Fishing... you know, How the Sea Fed Civilization, this book that we've been talking about over the several shows, and you realize it's not just the food, it's the whole way of life that is woven into the human experience. And it's going to be such a shame if we lose that part of it, that whole romance of fishing, I guess I would call it.
Yes, indeed. And recreational fishing, in a way, is keeping some of the legacy going.
I mean, it is.
I know some recreational fishermen who are extraordinarily knowledgeable, but really, it's it's a tragedy slowly happening in front of us. Same with game animals.
That's right.
Same thing.
Now, just before we hang up, I want to pay attention. You have a brand new book out, and we're going to do an interview on it coming up in the upcoming weeks, and I want to make people aware of it. It's called The Little History of Archaeology. First of all, that's a daring title to say A Little History of Archaeology. Like, that's saying A Little History of Physics. That's pretty brave to write that.
Well, actually, it's part of a series. Yale University Press has published, about 7 of these books now. It began with A Little History of the World.
Wow.
It's a bestseller. And then they've done one on philosophy. They've done one on economics and things like that. They've done about 7 or 8 now. They're doing more. But these books have been a huge success because they give you a short, succinct history of, say, archaeology in 40 chapters of 2,000 words each.
Oh, wow.
So you
have to, in other words, you're given the limits and you have to fit this book into those limits.
You do indeed.
Okay, don't say any more. We're going to do the interview about this. I'm psyched about it. The book just came in the mail.
Fascinating subject and a fascinating book.
My returning guest tonight has been Brian Fagan, emeritus professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. It's just a wonderful worldwide global history of fishing. And then also A Little History of Archaeology. Brian, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure for me too, Mark. You're a wonderful interviewer.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.